5 second delay. All right, looks like we're on live now. Hey guys, sorry we're a couple minutes late, but welcome to our weekly edition of Spilling Ink, the talk show that takes you behind the book to meet the authors and professionals in the publishing industry. And since Jason's not here, remember that we're your favorite hosts, Katie and Jane. We're your favorite hosts. How you doing tonight, Jane?
I'm doing great. How about you out west?
Doing good. Trying to stay cool. It is hot as hell out here.
And we have Levi and Sarah today.
Yeah. Hi, we're going to be talking about fun topics, I think. Who should we pick on to introduce themselves first? Should we do like an eeny, meeny, miny, moe here?
That's your choice. You're the guy's lead.
We used to ask who wanted to go first before we would do like in the pre-show and see who would throw the other person under the bus.
Well, then I'll throw Sarah under the bus. Sarah wants to go first.
Sure. I'll go.
All right, go for it, Sarah.
My name is Sarah. I am the author of the Runespell series and a metric ton of short stories and anthologies. You can find me everywhere except Pinterest because I don't understand Pinterest or Snapchat. But I am on authorgoddess.com and all of the social media platforms except for those two evil ones.
Two evil ones?
Evil. Oh, evil. Evil.
Yeah, I can't do all the social media platforms either. There's just too many to keep on top of.
Yeah.
All right, Levi, your turn. Go!
So I'm not yet quite a published author, but my name is Levi Davis. I'm actually the author, writer, designer, editor, extraordinaire, I guess. I'm not really good at editing, of a role-playing fantasy game called Legends of Kralis. And we're in the middle of finishing up our core rules, and I'm actually starting in the two-volume world guide for Legends of Kralis. So I've got some time to go, and it's still in the boiling pot trying to get ready.
But you say it like that, but that is no small feat in creating a huge game like this and the world that goes with it and the creatures that go with it. So we definitely want to talk a bit about that.
Well, there's so much involved in it, especially as a game designer. You know, we have to worry about rules that make sense, rules that people will enjoy. And then you have to take the abstract of that and say, okay, so without the rules, how does the world work? And then you have to create the world and then try to keep in mind that the rules that you built, whether it's for Dungeons and Dragons or any of these other cool games that are out there, and keep that going so it will be wanted and usable by anybody that wants to pick up this particular world. And that's hard to do. I've actually the book for the world guide itself, I'm going to actually have to split into two volumes of about 400 pages each.
Wow.
So while you guys are creating awesome reading material for your authorship and your fanship and all this other stuff, I have to create the worlds for you guys to set the characters in. You guys focus on a small part, but I need to know what's happening in the Northern Realms as much as the Southern Realms, what's happening on this world and what's happening on this continent and all this other stuff, trying to keep it all internally consistent. So when people read it, it's not like, okay, well, they said this and then over here they're doing something different. So yeah, I feel all of your pain magnified.
Consistency in any storytelling is the key too.
Right.
You know, whether it's through gaming or books or movies or anything like that, if you're inconsistent in any way, you jar the person who's having the entertainment experience.
Right. You break that fourth dimension and it just throws them out of it and they just don't want to be part of it anymore, you know? And that's, you know, you've got to draw them in as much as with your guys' writing, you know, because you guys have got characters that people begin to love, where I have, you know, you've got to create, you know, I've got to create New York for you so you can put your character in New York and know who's on this particular block kind of concept. Mm-hmm. So, no, you guys have got much worse than I do. I can kind of flood my way around because I can make up new things. And if you're using stuff that is in real world, you still got to work in consistency, I guess.
Yeah, actually, Jane, you and I have been doing something similar to that where you're helping me map out the places that our characters are going in the shared book that we're writing. So that keeping consistent, you know, you can't just throw something out there. It's got to actually fit within the world if you are writing in that real world situation.
Right.
Yes.
Internal consistency with anything that we write has got to be priority number one.
Yeah, and fantasy writers have a little bit more of, you know, what you're talking about, being able to make up anything, but they have to build the world. Like George R. R. Martin built incredible world for Game of Thrones, you know, the Song of Fire and Ice. So it's all building, and it has to be consistent throughout. So yeah, and you know, with maps and things like that, I've seen a lot of fantasy writers do that. So they know where people are, where, you know, their creatures are, where this, and all the laws that go around it.
Right.
Yes.
And some of the hardest part is, you know, fantasy readers, I think maybe you guys experience this, science fiction writers, fantasy readers, we are surrounded by so many tropes and so many classical, you can't break this image, that people want you to break those images. But yet when you do it, they go, oh, well, it's just that with this, isn't it? And it's like, well, that's one way to look at it, but that's a very simplistic view of it. And I think that can throw a lot of issues in our worlds off because, you know, you may think, you know, dragons, you know, like look at Martin's description of dragons. Technically, as I read it and I looked at it, they were wyverns. They had two legs. They didn't have four legs. Mm-hmm. You know, and those kinds of things, but they were still dragons.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And that can throw that kind of tropism that follows us is laid bare before us in a way that we got to be gentle around it unless we're going to completely shake it up. And then if we shake it up, we have to have everybody buy into it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the hardest part, is getting people to buy into your vision of this new trope or whatever, this archetype, whatever you want to call it. And it's difficult, you know, I mean, In my, I feel like I'm talking way too much. with fantasy and science fiction, you've got some of the biggest authors. You've got Tolkien, you've got Martin, you've got Asimov, you've got all these other people that have created this prehistory of these different types of characters. And, you know, when I say dwarf, you all kind of think of a dwarf. But when I say Kova, that kind of looks like a dwarf, but it's not a dwarf. It's kind of like, well, you don't get it. But if you use the tropes in the same similar vein as everybody else, then you get accused of, well, that's just the same old same thing that I can get over here. You guys aren't being nice.
Well, yeah. And, you know, along that line there, Tolkien also didn't create the dwarves. He borrowed them from Norse mythology. So he wasn't the original creator. He took and adapted.
Right. But when you think of dwarves, you don't think of the Norse mythologies behind them or the Trow or any of that other stuff. You immediately go to some of the biggest names out there. Tolkien is the first one. You know, that's why everything's called, you know, a lot of fantasy readers and fantasy designers that are in RPGs look at it as it being Tolkienized. Well, that's just Tolkienized, you know, and those kind of terms that get floated around. You know, it's just, he just took what was out there, made it more popular, and then people just ran with it, and then you end up with, you know, Gary Gygax and Dungeons and Dragons, Advanced Dungeons and Dragons being the precursor to everything, and then you have everybody else splitting off that. So you just gotta be careful.
In a way, it's really impossible to actually do any world building without building off of everything else that has come before. You know, like right now, I'm working on a short story that has a matrilineal kingdom. It's, you know, it's a queendom essentially. Mm-hmm. But there has to be like a reason for why this is unusual, even in this world. There has to be, you know, I have to dig into the politics of the history of that just to make it make sense. Even if it never actually makes it into the story, I have to know these things so I can drop those little, you know, tidbits where it's appropriate and things like that.
Right.
But I can't do that without understanding how matriarchal societies have worked in the past. I can't do that without looking at what distinct differences there might be in a matriarchal society versus a patriarchal society. I can't do that without looking at the sociology and determining which of these aspects I'm going to use. And I have to be consistent about it, or else it just kind of, you know, it's a kingdom with a wig slapped on it or something.
Yeah.
Just a king with a queen's wig.
Yes.
So
well, no, yeah. I think you're absolutely right on that. I mean, you have to make sure it's always internally consistent. And then you have to, you know, like for me, I have to build each and every one of my cultures, mm-hmm. you know, and you don't want it to be the same old culture. You know, I mean, if you think about dwarves and elves, when gamers talk about dwarves, they're like, okay, well, they're miners. They live inside mines. They live underground. You're like, well, yeah, that's a stereotype. And then everybody gets used to that stereotype. You say elves. Okay, well, they live in the forests. You know, they do this. You talk about gnomes and all these other things. People have got those different tropes. And to break out of those tropes can be jarring at time. And so, you know, while I've been developing my game, I've actually changed the names of a lot of my species names from certain things. I used to have dwarves. Now I call them Kova, and they don't really live underground. They build gigantic places and those kind of things. And it's hard to develop new things without someone going, oh, well, that's already been done over here. And you're like, yeah, they did it that way, but I'm doing it this way. And then that doesn't fly with everybody because they have, you know, they're loyal to their brand, I guess, in one sense. And that's hard. And yeah, if you can do it.
It's always fun to take a trope or something like a fairy tale and twist it. Katie knows I've done that.
Well, right. And that's what I'm saying. You guys have got, probably a harder job because you have to actually take the trope. And if you're going to do like, you know, like say Alice in Wonderland and do a twist on that, that's hard to do because you're messing with someone's, they've got a love for Alice in Wonderland. And then you just throw a nightmare in there. It's kind of like what they did with Pride, Prejudice, and Zombies.
Yeah.
You know? It's like kind of a cool twist, you know, but you got to be careful about how far you twist it before someone gets it. Where on my side of the world, I can kind of like shrug my shoulders and go, well, eh, if you don't like it, you don't like it, you know, but I've got to be consistent about making, okay, this is that. Where I don't have to worry about writing. And I've talked to Katie. I'm like, I'm overly purple. And she's like, no, you're not. I'm like, oh, yeah, I am. I can't write to save my soul. So you guys are awesome comparatively.
We are all our worst critics. And I say the same thing to you when you sent me samples to read. You have great stuff. You just have to believe in yourself a little bit more. And to look at, just to give you guys an example of what he sent me. When he's talking about these game manuals, if you've ever been a gamer, you know how much detail they put on just like a single page. Compare that to a novel page, and you're probably looking at 3 or 4 novel pages worth of material on this one page. And he's talking about 2 books worth of this material. That is no small feat. That's a lot of stuff that you've been working on. Granted, you've been working on it for how many years?
Too many.
Yeah. But it shows. There's that dedication, and there's that time put into it, and you've... As you write, you always improve.
Right. And that's what I'm saying. I've had to throw things out, and I pull things from everything for cultures. You know, I mean, you know, I'm actually sitting down and I'm actually reading a 1,000 page encyclopedia of our world cultures. And there are cultures that, you know, you don't even know exist. And then you read it, you're like, oh, wow, that's very cool. How can I flip that into something that I can use? But then you have to be careful that if you use it and someone knows about that particular culture and you don't really understand it and you use it to describe something, it can bite you in the rear end very, very badly, very quickly. It can be used as, well, you didn't know what you were writing about, and that's insulting. You're like, I didn't mean it to be that way. You know?
That's interesting because that kind of touches on the topic of diversity on another show we were on earlier where, you know, when you're writing from – let's say a white person writing as an African-American. There's that issue sometimes where some people don't want you to write from that perspective because they don't think you can appreciate and write from that cultural perspective well. So it becomes a really interesting debate on what you should use, how you should approach it, and whether or not people are going to accept it, depending on who's actually writing the material.
And then when you write it, you're accused of whitewashing.
Interestingly enough, it's actually easier to write people of color as a white person in fantasy because, you know, like the big issue is that you have to bring in all of that, you know, for lack of a better term, historical baggage. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't just write people of color and ignore the fact that there was slavery. That's not how that works. But in a fantasy world, maybe there wasn't slavery or the slavery wasn't racially based or, you know, something like that. So you can do it that way. And that's a really nice way to bring in some people of color as characters that, you know, can be identified with in, you know, because you're not making it about their race per se, you're just making a diverse cast. Yeah. And because you don't have to have the same cultural background for those characters, you have a little more liberal liberty with how you develop that character.
Right. No, right. And you guys, like I said, you got a little bit harder than I think than people who actually design games. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, we as designing games and fantasy worlds doesn't mean that we can't and don't have to be, I don't want to say soft, but we have to be aware of the diversity factor where we, if we don't include enough, but if we include them to be a one way, then we are definitely whitewashing it or making it from our perspective that, hey, you know, white colonialism, for instance, is the power behind a lot of fantasy books. You know, it's all about from the perspective of the European colonization of the world. Well, flip it on its rear, on its ear, and then you say, okay, well, what if you have a black colonization of the world? What does that look like? And unfortunately, we have to make guesses on that because of what happened in our real world, right? I mean, we don't know what would happen if it was flipped. You know, what if what's his name? I can't think of his name now. Oh, it was a power, Zulu. What if Zulu actually rose to the power and the level that the British Empire did, and they took over in the opposite direction?
Well, you know, I mean, that goes into history again, because, you know, the history and the culture of Britain is different from the history and culture of Zulu's native culture. And that could change the way that all of that is even, you know, approached.
Right. Right. You know? And I'm always afraid of stepping into that, because I don't want to make it sound like I don't know what I'm writing or what I'm reading. And I don't want to sound insensitive or any of those terminologies. I want to be an inclusive author, you know, and now inclusion means more than just the color of someone's skin. It's their sexual orientation. It's how they identify who they are. And that is, it's become a very sticky ground, but it's a ground that we as authors and as writers, we need to tread across boldly and say, you know, it doesn't matter. All this stuff just doesn't matter. You need to be able to put yourself in a story. I read a really awesome story set in the future of a, well, she's definitely black, and she comes from a black culture, but she comes from a very specific tribe in Africa. It's so awesome. I just, you know, I don't know. I'm just afraid of making mistakes, and that's why I take so long writing when I write.
Well, historically, sci-fi specifically, and fantasy in general, has been used as a way to tackle some of these issues in a very, I guess, easy to digest format, you know, because you aren't using historical basis as much for their reality. You're able to show different cultures and different ways that they can work together, or what causes wars, or, you know, the different religious beliefs and how they create problems, without saying specifically these religions, these cultures, and what have you.
But that's where you have to be careful, because when you start to use, you know, specific concepts, like, you know, you know it's like what's that one movie, The Golden Compass, right? The book was kind of anti-Catholicism, anti-church, right? And it got beat up by a lot of people, and we never saw the next movie that was beyond that because it got beat up so bad.
And yet now they're remaking it. I think HBO is picking it up.
Yes, yes, they are. They're actually going to make it. They're going to make it a very long, I think I read it, like an 8-year or an 8-season series. Holy about this. I just, you know, HBO rocks.
Yeah, well, they have the backing to be able to tackle some of these things that mainstream doesn't necessarily want to touch.
Right.
But it's good that they do. And again, like I said, sci-fi has been historically, and fantasy too, the ways to tackle it. Look at Star Trek. That was all based on trying to show the diverse cast. Look at the very first, the original Star Trek. The diversity was right there, right in front of your face, but they played it off as this is normal. This is the way our crew is built. And these are the things we're doing. And what were they doing? They were exploring. They were meeting new cultures, learning how to deal with new cultures. Every single episode, that's what that was about. And it's you know, sci-fi's way of kind of teaching us or showing us in a way without pandering so much.
Absolutely. Gene Roddenberry was an incredible writer about getting that going and doing that. If you ever get the opportunity, you should read or watch For the Love of Spock. If you ever have the opportunity, watch that movie. It's done very well and shows you a lot of the interest behind it.
All
right, no, you're right, Josie. Didn't really touch on the denomination of the church, but it was definitely based off the Christian movies.
Yeah, and I think I remember the movie from a very long time ago, and yet it did seem like it was anti, just Christianity in general type religious based.
Right.
But then again, you need stuff like that. You need to see it. You need stuff that will make you question. As long as society will accept that.
Right, and that's you hit the wall, smack on. As long as society will accept it, and that's the hard part. You know, you don't want to write something that's going to, you know, you're not going to be able to write to make sure everybody is accepted. Everybody's going to have an issue with whatever you write at some point, whether it's too much feminism or it's too much male machoism, whether it's too much, you know, this or too much that. You're never going to please everybody, you know, and that's one of the hard realizations that I'm slowly coming to is I got to write something that I enjoy and hopefully I don't piss off the world.
Well, I think we're in a good time frame for it, though, right now. You know, they're bringing back the Golden Compass in the TV series, but we're also seeing a lot more push for diversity, a lot more push for showing things that maybe previously weren't going to be accepted. So we're moving towards a generation that is willing to take that look at things that they wouldn't have before and maybe accept them and learn from them.
There was when I was actually going through my, not even my rule, even the rule book, I had one person look at it and they wrote that, well, you are with what you're writing here and how you're not using this, you're making it sound like the people that I'm attuned to are going to be disenfranchised. And I thought in the back of my head when I read it from this person, I'm like, I kind of want that to happen. I want you to be disenfranchised. I want you to not have be all about you. And unfortunately, this was coming from a white male perspective. And I'm like, good. I'm glad it offends you. It should offend you. You should be like that.
And Rebecca says everyone sees art differently, which is absolutely true. Everyone's going to take something different out of it.
There's a famous quote, and I don't remember who said it, and I don't remember the exact quote, but it's pretty much, if you're going to make art, specifically literature, and you don't do it in such a way that at least somebody hates you, you're doing it wrong.
Right.
I'm going to make many people hate me. Just, you know.
I have a few books that are polarizing. Either people love them or they hate them. And I'm like, okay, well, you know, I'm sorry you hate it, but at least it evoked emotion.
Well, and I think that's the point is, you know, like, I don't really, like, I do, of course, want people to like my books. But at the same time, you know, if you hate it, did it at least make you think?
Yes.
If that's what you can get out of it, great, fine. I don't care if it makes you uncomfortable. I don't care if it makes you, you know, feel bad, because, you know, quite frankly, a lot more people need to feel bad about what is going on in the world, what has gone on in the world, and, you know, things like that. I have no problem with that. We really favor people's comfort way too much over other people's actual lives. And that is a huge problem in my book. So, you know, if you being uncomfortable can improve somebody else's life, bummer. We all stub our toes. Deal.
Yes.
Well, and that's I think that's why you guys have got such a much more difficult job than I do, where you know I can sit back and I can write about a whole country, and let's call this country Wakanda, and in this country of Wakanda, everybody is going to be of a black persuasion, that they're going to have a clannish type of historical thing about it, and you're going to just go with it. You know, I mean, and that's a perfect example. I mean, Stan Lee, you know, was an amazing author and artist in the sense of he pushed the boundaries with the comics. And there's a lot of things out there that are in those comics that we're looking at today and going, wow, that was done in the 70s. Mm-hmm. That was done at this time. And they were pushing it because they didn't want to exclude anybody. They wanted to include everybody, and they wanted to give the people more power, because, you know, in a lot of, and I've seen so many stories and read so many different things from different people about how those comic books touched them at a moment in their life that made them understand, I'm not alone in this world. And they get me. You know, I mean, look at the Black Panthers, look at Black Lightning, look at Wonder Woman, look at Supergirl, look at all this, you know, and I kind of get a giggle in my mind when I see so many fanboys, you know, hit the internet with a frenzy of why they don't want this particular person to play this particular character because she isn't what they thought it was going to be. And I'm like, stick it where the sun doesn't shine, please. Because I mean, who are you to decide? You didn't write this. I'm sorry if it didn't fit your little, you know, microcosm of what made you feel good about the comic book. Get over it. Enjoy the fantasy. Enjoy the moment, you know, and move on. And
to expand on this, the idea of putting these tropes and turning them on their ear is very important, because there is so much concept around the normal being white and male, skewing at least. And to be able to take those tropes and just be like, no, we're not even going to address that. We're just going to go straight for the, you know, the superhero is an angry black woman, and she's awesome that way. So deal with it, you know. Go for it. Have fun. You know, I love those things, because it's pretty much saying what you think is normal is not what everybody else gets to be normal about. And that is no longer going to be okay.
I don't think there's a definition for normal anymore. What's normal?
When Hollywood agrees with you.
Well, Hollywood is not normal in itself. I mean, right. Seriously.
Well, okay. So one of my favorite stories is at a book convention, a writer's convention. We had this guy who came to do a presentation on how to rewrite your works so that into a screenplay so that you could sell it to Hollywood, kind of thing, right? Mm-hmm. And so I approached him because I was like, hey, you know what? I have a 9-book series planned out and people are really liking this heroine and yada yada. And so I was like, you know, should I even look into this? You know, I just kind of gave him the spiel, and he was like, so does she have a boyfriend? No. Does she have any kind of lovers whatsoever? No. Then we can't buy it. What? You know, like, oh, so because you have a vagina, you have to be putting something in it or else it's not saleable. And he looked at me and he said, we know what women are going to go watch in the movie theaters, and what you have is not it. And I'm like, and I'm chopped liver, because I know what I would go watch in the movie theaters. And last time I checked, I like strong women characters, you know, not just but, you know, I like powerful women characters regardless of whether they're in a relationship.
Captain Marvel is like, a perfect example of somebody who doesn't have a love relationship in that movie.
Right.
It was great.
Well, see, and that's the kind of thing, you know, I mean, if you look at Wonder Woman, right, the movie that they did, and you look at the Captain Marvel movies, and then you see those scenes that just, I mean, those movies, from my perspective, I think both the directors, who are, I believe, are both female for both of those, took it upon themselves to put the power of the woman out there in such a way that it's attractive. And I think that's where people are saying is, if your character isn't attractive in a powerful way, then they're not going to be as accepting as someone who kind of makes it through, they meander through. But those movies, Captain Marvel and Wonder Woman, are two of my, they're in the top 10 of the movies that I currently watch, and I watch a lot of them. Those two are very powerful, and I love them. I think same with Black Panther. I mean, look at it in just in general, the numbers, if you want to look at it, well, how powerful was it? How popular was it? Look at the amount of money that those movies have made in themselves. That should tell you to the community that normal is no longer normal, and we need to get this, our heads out of our asses, and start looking at it going, you know what? What does the world want to see? You know, mm-hmm. We can't look at it from a white cis environment anymore. You can't do that. And that's something that's been happening over the last, 15, 20 years.
Rebecca makes a really good comment here too. She said that says about 20% of the U.S. population is the straight white Christian males. Why are we catering to that minority? Unfortunately, those are the ones with the money, which is why.
That's the horrible truth about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hold on, and she's she adds to that. She says white women, even Christian white women, have more money, ignoring the top 0.1%. But unfortunately, it's still, you know, it's the old boys club making a lot of the decisions.
Well, absolutely. You know, we've talked about gatekeepers in I don't know how many interviews now that and podcasts that I've done, where that is a huge problem, where we need to focus more on supporting the people who are willing to ignore those concepts that are really just inaccurate at this point. And instead of going through these traditional gatekeepers, we need to really push the boundaries and see what people want. Because, I mean, the thing is, even guessing what people want, if you want it, chances are somebody else wants it too.
Well, that's the beauty of indie, is indie can reach out and try something new. Big Five is corporation. It's going to go where the money's at. It's got to show its profits at the end of the year. It's, you know, accountable to its shareholders. So they will never be free enough to just pick and choose at random. They're always going to go with whatever is trending, whatever is, you know.
Well, I don't know if that's necessarily true anymore. I mean, look at what Disney's doing, right? I mean, right now they sit on top of the film empire. I mean, they are the Lion King here. Right. But what are they doing? They're taking things and they're turning them up on their head. It's like Aladdin. I wanted to go see Aladdin. And my wife's like, nope, because I like the cartoon better. I'm like, OK, well, why? Well, because it's Robin and it's all this. I'm like, they're doing something new. They're doing something different. You know, Marvel's going to push the envelope. Watch over the next 5 years. You're going to see Marvel push an envelope in such a way that it's really going to make the fanboys lose their shit. They really will. We're going to see more types and different types of diversity than you've ever seen before. You know, the buildup in the last 10 movies, if you watched it slowly, it's been a buildup towards pushing the environment the way Marvel has always wanted to push it, the way Stan Lee has always pushed it, and the way that the way it needs to be pushed. And as writers and as world builders, it's kind of up to us to either go, okay, am I going to accept the norm, whatever the norm is, or am I going to break outside of the norm and try to do something outside of the box, despite what everybody says out there? And unfortunately, that the loudest voices, Katie, are the ones with the biggest money, or the ones who have got to make a point. They're going to be the loudest, meanest voices out there. And our hope as authors, I think, is to be able to reach those that are on the that are disenfranchised, that are on the outside, that, hey, you know, they are reaching to me, they are speaking to me, and we allow them to grow in their own power about who they believe themselves are, who they believe they are, and help them grow in that position. You know, that's what Marvel did for a lot of people, you know? And I think you're going to see a lot of different things. But the top five isn't necessarily who's got the biggest money. It's who's the ones going to yell the loudest.
Well, and that's the downside of the indie marketplace is you don't have the money to back up your stuff. It's a lot harder to get the organic growth to reach the people that you want to reach. I mean, it's not impossible. I'm not saying you can't do it, but you do have to get over that hurdle. Whereas the big five out there, while they have the gatekeepers and they are preventing maybe some of this stuff from being seen, they have the money to back it up.
They're just the big kid on the block screaming at their cotton candy isn't the way it's supposed to be done. And I think, you know, back in the early 90s, early 2000s, the indie market was really an indie market, right? It was underground. It tended to be something that people didn't really see as much. And as we get further and further along, I think you're going to start seeing a lot more independent things happen, you know, and some of the bigger ones that are out there that are actually developing and taking in the indie market is Netflix, Amazon. You know, unfortunately, you know, you may have problems with them, but they are reaching out to the indie market and going, okay, hey, we like what you're saying. We're going to pull that in. We're going to make this story. We're going to do that. You know, I mean, look at Stranger Things.
Yeah, Stranger Things pushed the envelope, I think, out of the norm, and everybody loved it.
Joe says that it's more than profit now. It's laziness because it's such a machine that it's becoming an automated process. Interesting.
Couldn't agree more.
I would have to agree with that because statistically, the things that the big five say makes the most money really, really doesn't.
Mm-mm.
You know, they act like they're risk adverse. They act like they're just following the money. But the thing is, they're just using the same old stuff over and over again because, well, it made money in the past. But even when the numbers show that that's not what's making money now, they're sticking with it. And, you know, hopefully that'll cut their power a little bit. But
essentially, they're creating the market trend that they're following then.
Exactly.
Right. And exactly.
You know, if you only have movies in the theater that are starring white men, then what are you going to go see? A movie starring a white man.
I think that's a real travesty to us as a people. You know, we're no longer trapped. We're no longer trapped by our, like we were in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, even the 90s. We're no longer trapped by a lack of communication, the way we do things nowadays. You know, unfortunately, we've got things that happen out there. We've got Twitter, we've got Facebook, we've got Mew, we've got all these different social platforms where it's an instantaneous response, whether it's a knee-jerk reaction or a well-thought-out thing that just explodes. And I think we need to start using that. Well, it's obvious. Everybody knows that we need to start using it to battle against those big five. And it doesn't matter. You guys have got your big five. I've got my two big guys on the block. You know, we've got Wizards of the Coast and Piazzo. I can never say that right. Piazzo. I know I'm going to get hammered on that one. The Golem. Those are the two big. You know, those are the 800-pound gorillas sitting on the block, not letting anybody else do anything. And if you're an indie developer, if you're not developing for the new Dungeons & Dragons or the new Pathfinder, you're nothing. Because no one wants, you know, everybody wants to play that particular game because that's what's popular, you know. And it's giving the geek side of the world its blessings with certain actors now having certain things going on is awesome because it brings in more people to see what was going on, and hopefully it allowed them to move beyond what they were first introduced to, right?
Yeah, and I think a lot of us, especially those of us who live in the indie realm, we're a lot more willing to give the indie world a chance, whether it's movies, whether it's games, whether it's books. I just got an indie game from the last convention that I went to, and I found it just absolutely fun to play. My kids were playing it, and it was a game that I would never seen going to whether it's at a bookstore or a toy store. I'd have never seen it. It's totally 100% indie funded game, and it was great. And we need more of this out there.
That speaks again to the money, because, I mean, the thing is, how often do you buy a book and you check the publisher to make sure it's a big five before you buy it, right? People don't do that. People look for books that they love, but you don't get those books in front of a lot of people's faces unless you have the money for the marketing on that. So, you know, it really is a lot about being able to fund these marketing practices. And, you know, shout out to all my indie people who help each other market, because, dude, that's really the only way we can survive.
Yeah,
it's totally a pay-to-play system at this point. And if you don't have the money, you can't get your product in front of other people. And you can do as much guerrilla marketing as you want and hopefully getting people to share, but really, if you can't get that visibility, no matter how much work you've done, it's not going to be seen.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because there's a flood of everybody, you know, and their brother putting out work, whether it's ready or not. And then you have scammers. Yeah. So those lovely people that you just want to shoot.
Yeah, they just ruin it for the rest of us.
Right.
Yeah, and then Amazon comes down with the ban hammer and then screws everybody over.
Right.
Thanks.
Exactly.
Now, oh, Rebecca gives another good comment here. Not once in her entire life has she decided to buy a book based on publisher. I'm the exact same way. I will buy based on cover. I am one of those people who, if I see a really cool cover, I'll buy the book whether or not I want to read it.
So you're the problem, Katie. You're the problem.
No, because I will buy the book still. I will still go, that's really cool, and I'll buy it.
Yeah, but you're part of the problem.
Buy cover?
We all judge books by their cover, unfortunately. That's a proven fact.
Well, you know, and the thing is, you know, there's a certain point of it. I mean, I'll admit that there are times where I've picked up books because of the cover. And I'm one of those people that actually read the first five pages. If I can't get through the first five pages, I put you back. I don't care if you're from whomever. If I can't get through those first five pages, or if I go to the back of your book and your back of your book is blah, I'll put you back. I don't care who you're produced by, you know, and that seems kind of mean, but I want, you know, your cover could be the ugliest cover in the world, but if the book and the story is well done, I don't care about the cover.
Sarah gets high fives from Rebecca. Now, it's not to say that I won't buy a book that has an ugly cover on it, but a pretty cover will almost always make me just grab an impulse buy.
Right. Now, right.
As far as, you know, whether or not I'm going to buy books, I mostly go indie these days. It's kind of rare that I read a regular, traditionally published book. Most of the time, I'm going to like the indie bookshops and I'm grabbing books off the shelf or secondhand bookstores. And most of my reading lately has been beta reading. So it is all indies that I'm reading.
Mm-hmm.
But I just, you know, if it looks good and it sounds good, I'm going to buy it because I want entertainment. I don't care who's producing that entertainment.
Yeah, that kind of creates a whole nother cycle, though, because, you know, indie authors may not have capital. Capital is required to buy a good book cover. If you want to buy a book cover, then you want to pay a fair price or else you're shafting the illustrators and graphic designers. And then you have a lot of indie graphic designers who are underpricing their work in order to try and get sales because they can't get any sales because all the indie people are poor.
Don't
have it. It's like, Indiegogo, everybody, okay?
Well, yeah, and that's where sites like Patreon or Kickstarter, you know, all of these crowdfunding sources have popped up, which is great. If you can get them funded, that's awesome. But there's got to be another way to do it without, I don't know.
Well, then here's another problem. Now that you brought that up, I'm going to stick my fork in that one. You've got Kickstarter. Kickstarter was a great indie platform for people who are doing something independent to create something that cannot normally get funded by whatever. But now it's starting to become a commercial place where people who have big names are able to do things, are using it to get you to pre-purchase their book before the book is actually even written, or if it's half written and it looks good. And there are a lot of people that are doing that, and especially in the gaming world, there are a lot of people who have got companies already who already are supported by a specific company, and they're like, okay, well, we're on Kickstarter, and it's got, you know, Walt Disney's name behind it. So, all right, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to support that. Well, then there's people like me and a couple of other authors and gamers that are like, well, we're doing this. Well, who do you have on your Kickstarter? Who's developing it? Who's doing this? Well, I am. Well, who are you? Nobody really, but I think you like my game, you know, and then you see the people are getting funded in 4 minutes, and you're like, what the? And then you go and you look at it, they got people behind them, or they're not. You're starting to see this influx. That's not to say that it's everywhere, but there's a lot of influx coming in from, you know, game designers who have got their companies established, are now starting to use it as a way to get you to pre-buy the product before they've even developed the product or fully developed the product. Where Kickstarter was originally, okay, I'm done. Now I need $10,000 so I can finish the art. And then we're done and we'll send this all out. Now it's like, okay, we need to get to, you know, $9,000 or $10,000 just so we can get started. And it's like, you know, then you have all these people who are manipulating Kickstarter in such a way as to get more support. You know, and then you have those people who use Kickstarter and you never see a product ever. Mm-hmm. You know, and unfortunately it tends to be those few wolves and coyotes out there that are the bad apples that make it bad for all the indies. Especially if you're on Kickstarter, you know, like, oh, you know, he's got this great game going, he's got this thing going, we're gonna do this, and then suddenly a year later, haven't seen anything, but we, you know, he's got $200,000. Well, where'd he go? I don't know.
Right. They took the money and ran.
Right.
The other aspect of that is because they already have people who are backing them and behind them and the big companies that are already supporting them and everything, they're able to put out a cleaner presentation on Kickstarter, which makes them look more attractive, which kind of raises the bar for, you know, me and my ghetto laptop and movie maker video for my, you know, taking a book into hardcover audiobook or something like that, where, you know, it's just like it becomes more and more impossible for people who don't already have the money to get the money.
Right. And it's no longer a platform for indie developers. It's a platform for people who've already got the backing, who are just looking to get you, like I said, to pre-purchase a product before the product's even finished.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's, it's sad. And it's just, and in one sense, it destroys the people who are really good with their indie game designs or book designs or book writing, I think, you know.
Well, and then you've got sites like Patreon, which I guess are supposed to be the more, I guess, regular funding to continue your art, where I don't know if others have, if you guys have tried it, but for me, it seems like it's just another tool to shout into the void, where if you haven't already established a base on Patreon, it's another social media site that I've got to drag people from whatever social media I found them on over to, rather than, you know, an all-inclusive, you know, place for them to go and share and hopefully contribute a little bit to. I don't know, do either of you guys do Patreon at all?
Yep.
Are you finding it the same, where it's like you're having to drag people over when, you know, you're already on Facebook and you're posting, you're already on Twitter and you're posting? It's
you know, I actually replaced all of my blogs with Patreon in the hopes that, you know, just having earlier access would encourage people to, you know, do more. But really, it's just a matter of, there aren't enough people who really understand how long it can take to write a book, to put out a book, to do this and that. And they want the instant gratification, they want the instant rewards. And the big issue is, you know, even if I have like 5 short stories that I can just give people, well, that's only 5 short stories. How long is that going to last? You know, seriously, you can read all of the.
Well, and I think, but Patreon is actually, Patreon isn't really, it's not a good place for writers to be. it because of the instant gratification. It's a, right. a lot of the Patreons that I am behind is that it's that or that I'm that I watch are people who are doing things that are like an instantaneous, you know, map design or mini adventure design or those kind of things.
Yeah,
I don't know how as an author when you're already dealing with what anywhere from $40,000 to $100,000 word, $100,000 word novel, how you can spit out a 25,000 short story to give to Patreons while you're still working on this other set of stuff. I don't understand how you guys could do it. I don't know if it's really a good tool for you guys as novel writers. Ah, where'd I go?
Right. And you know, the again, you get into that cycle where if you're going to do it, then you have to have the writing and the ability to support yourself before you can get yourself on there enough and in such a way that you can support yourself on it. So it's like, well, if I already had the money, why am I going to go through all this effort?
Right.
So it's just, it's an interesting thing because it kind of speaks to a really big change in the mindset of people towards art, which, you know, kind of works with the name. Patreon is about being a patron of the arts. You know, yes, you're dropping $2-3 a month on, you know, 5 or 6 different people each. You're supporting them as artists, not because they're going to give you something every month, but because you have seen what they've already put out. You find that valuable and you want them to be able to do more.
But it's based off that Kickstarter system of rewarding right. people on tier levels, which then creates that whole pressure of, okay, now I have to make sure that I'm constantly offering more services than just focusing right. on the writing, which you're supposed to be my fan of.
For which actually trains people to only support people if they're getting something immediately from it. You know, as opposed to this idea of just having more artistic license available to somebody whose work you already appreciate.
Well, I'm wondering then if you guys couldn't use it in such a way as to drop chapters as you guys have gotten them done. You know, okay, here's chapter one, or here's part of chapter one. And then, you know, if you're at a certain tier, you get to see chapters 2 through 3 and those kind of things. Or, you know, and it's not something that they can keep or anything like that where they can read it. And then they can support you based off of what they've read. I don't know if that's something that would work for you guys or not. You know, most of the stuff that I've done for Patreon, and granted, I haven't really been doing it because I've been focusing on getting whatever I'm developing done so I can move on. Eventually, to support the game community, we're going to be adding things for new adventures, mini adventures, things that can be instantly dropped once or twice a week that don't take a lot of time. Where, like I said, you guys have got, you know, I mean, look at, you know, Ender's Game. Ender's Game was a short story. It's 25,000 words, but it's a short story. I don't know how long it would take you guys to write 25,000 words in such a way that would be a short story like that. You know, I mean, I don't know. I mean, there's times I'm writing and I have to get up and I have to walk out for like a day. I'm like, I'm done. I'm, my brain's done. Well, I don't know how you guys do it.
You're in my private group on Facebook, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so you know that I do post teasers in there.
Yes, ma'am.
Now, I also go to Patreon, and I will post full chapter teasers, and those are on those tiered levels. The problem I run into is I'm trying to use Patreon as that whole, you know, I'm offering, you know, new content for, you know, $1, $2, whatever the tier price is. People will read it on the Facebook group. Just fine. If I post it, you know, the link to where you can read the full chapter, and it's a work in progress chapter. I make sure to tell people about it right at the beginning. They don't go. They will not transfer over. So if it's not right there on the platform they're used to reading on, they won't shift over.
Well, I think, well, then this is going to sound harsh. Then that's a blame on your readership, not you. It's a blame on the people that are supposed to be saying that they're supporting you. It's a blame on them. It's not a blame on what you're doing or anything like that. They just need to, it just, you know, they need to be able to understand that to consume it, they're going to have to learn how to consume it in different ways, you know? And I think that's the problem, you know? And I don't know if it's a generational issue or what. Millennials love Patreon. They devour that stuff. If they've hooked into it, you're done, you're set, you're golden. I don't know if it's, like I said, a generational thing. You know, I mean, I don't know. And how to get people to move from one platform to another platform, I guess, is the reason why I guess they say you need an SEO. I don't know. I just don't.
Yeah. It's been my frustration, and I haven't stopped posting the chapters there, but I get a lot more interaction on my private Facebook group posting my little snippets of teasers, because I won't even be able to post the full chapter on there because it's too long. Facebook doesn't like super long posts.
So one of the things that I've noticed, though, is when you do post that, I haven't seen you put like a Patreon link on it. Maybe you should do that at the end. Hey, for more, here's the Patreon link. Maybe that might work.
Doing that. I usually have a separate post with the Patreon link to it, but we could try that.
Maybe just blend it. I mean, it's not going to cost you any more to do it.
Right.
Just do it.
Although admittedly, the private group gets things before anywhere else.
Well, right. And I think that's what you have to look at. Is, you know, the people who are in your private group, you know, I have a small, very limited design group. It's got 10 people in it. That's it. And anybody else has to go someplace else, or they have to wait, or they have to wait to see me at a con or something like that. And I'm not saying I'm popular by any means, but I think that if you oversaturate your own market with people who you want, who are, oh, I want to be a part of that because I want to be part of the first people to actually do that, you know.
Now Rebecca makes a very good post as well. It's hard to stalk your favorite author across multiple platforms. And the problem with being an indie author is you have to be on all of those platforms, or you're missing some of your audience. So it's another damned if you do, damned if you don't situation.
Right.
Yep.
Mm. Right, yeah. But that's what I'm thinking. That's what, you know, Patreon is not necessarily another application that you need. I know that I've never read anything on Patreon on my phone. It's either on my tablets or on my laptops. I've met, you know, and that's, you know, I mean, I'm probably sticking my foot in it. Again, I think that, you know, it's not that hard. We're all technologically capable. Now, if we're talking about, you know, our parents who are, you know, in their late 80s, early 90s, that might be an issue. But we're talking about people who've been sitting in front of a laptop or a computer for the better half of 20 years. You know, come on, people, roll with us. Get on the platform. Get on the bandwagon. Let's go. You guys are, you know, I'll, if I liked you, you know, I'll stalk you.
He brings you treats then. Rebecca's a professional stalker, if you haven't noticed.
Good stalking, yeah, though. Good stalking.
You make a point. It's really easy to connect with people these days, and yet sometimes the ease of connection is making it harder for us to maintain the connection that we need. So, well, you know.
The thing is this. You see, you look at it as maybe. You're looking at is it's like it's hard for me to maintain that connection. No, it's not hard for you to maintain the connection, because you're gonna type your thing, you're gonna put your little link at the bottom of your thing for Patreon, boom, there you're done. It's on the other people, you know, to actually click on that link and do it. That's where it matters the most, right? You know, and there's always this concept that people are going to do what they want to do based on how much or how important it is to them.
That is very true. That is
absolutely. I will argue one point. My phone, which is my poor ancient phone, is approaching 2 years old, and I literally have to like make sure that I delete all of my pictures and everything, because I am running out of memory. I can't install any more apps. So it's an interesting dilemma, because sometimes we don't always have the capability to access the technology as easily as it appears without a huge investment. I mean, you know, a new phone is what, $100, $200? I don't even know what they run it anymore. I'd put it on my account. And then they sign another 2 year contract that I'm just indebted to everybody. It's okay. Support me on Patreon.
Yeah,
our Patreon. Well, no, and I don't disagree with that. I and that's a very valid point. But I'm going to counter argue your counterpoint. Take off some of your images. Find the applications that matter to you. You know, that's what, again, like I said, you know, and you actually made my argument for me. How important is it for you to be able to do X? What are you willing to do for X? If you're not willing to stop taking 10 pictures a day and have room for your application, then there's nothing I can do. I can't sit here and sweet talk you or say, hey, you know, if you do this, I'll give you a dollar. You know, right? Exactly. The ultimate point is people are going to do what's important to them. People are going to read what they feel is important to themselves.
Right. Well,
no offense, Katie. I bought everything except for the last book from Katie. Haven't quite got to reading it yet. But when I see her, I load up on her stuff. I'm like, give it to me. And then it sits on my bookshelf for a while because I'm way behind on my reading, as you can tell.
and that's to the other side of the point, too. While, yes, it is on our readers to click that link when we post it, it is also on us as the authors putting on the marketing hats to make those teasers enticing enough to get the reader to click.
Yeah. Right. Which makes it important for them to click on it. That's it, like I said, it boils down to how do you make me feel as someone who should be reading your stuff? You know, I can't remember his name now. It's slipping my tongue. People won't remember what you did. People remember you for how you made them feel,
mm-hmm.
right? If I feel that this is something that's going to be awesome and I love it, whether it's you know, a little tiny bit, it's enough for me to remember, oh, you know, Katie wrote this really good story about this dragon and this girl, and I really wish she'd finish up on doing this again and writing this one story. I love that story. She hasn't done it, Katie. You need to get back to that story, Katie.
I will. I promise. On the list right now.
After ours.
I have three books I'm writing right now with Jane.
No. You don't understand. You need to get back to that one. That one's already pre-done. You've got buyers for that one. But that's the point, right? It's important to me.
Yeah.
It may not be important to you as a writer because you've got these three other books, but it's important to me that you write this book because I want to see what's happening. Or, you know, it's like Star Wars or Star Trek. It's important that they write these stories to make me feel good about the story. I mean, that's why Star Trek lasted for so long. You know, I mean, if you look at Star Trek, the original series, it was only on for 3 years. But how many of us can go back and watch those over and over again? Trouble with Tribbles, one of my favorite episodes, right? But then the Next Generation came along. People are like, oh my God, this is better than Gold. I'm like, the original series is pretty good. Just watch that, you know? But it made us feel something. And that's what it boils down to, is how do you make your readership feel? You know, they may not like one particular character, but that may be enough for them to hate that character so much that they pick up the book hoping that you've killed off that character. Oh, he's still alive, scum bucket, you know?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and you know, one of my
thrones going for so long, everyone was waiting for Cersei to die,
right? And well, that was just a bad death. Let's not get into that. We're gonna have to agree to disagree on a lot of that, Katie.
We're gonna not touch on that subject. Actually, we are over time. We may have to bring you guys back in to continue this debate another time because this is a good conversation.
Anytime.
But so we've hit our time limit. I want to thank our audience members who've been posting comments. You guys have had great comments. And Levi, Sarah, you've been wonderful. So I definitely want to bring you guys back on when we get a chance. Thank you for hanging out with us. And Jane, yay, Jane. I'm glad that you were able to be well enough to show up today.
Yes. Summer cold, thankfully. I think it's at the tail end. Hopefully I'll be, you know, cough free by next weekend.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah. Garlic soup. That's all I can say. Garlic soup.
All right, guys. We will be back next week with some more authors to talk to and some more fun discussions. Like I said, Levi, Sarah, I'm going to get you back on again to continue this debate another time.
Awesome. Bye, guys.
Bye. Bye.